Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. This season, we hear from the guest speakers from ISF's 2021 Digital Congress. Today, ISF CEO Steve Durbin sits down with trust expert, author, and lecturer at Oxford University, Rachel Botsman. They discuss the nature of trust, how trust differs from transparency, and how to build a culture of trust within your organization.
Rachel, thanks very much for spending time on this podcast. You spoke at our Digital 2021 Congress, mm-hmm. and a lot of people, members who listened to that, I think were fascinated by the way in which you talked about trust, how it's built, because you are a trust fellow. You talk about trust at business school in Oxford, don't you? One of the things that was intriguing me, and I think some of the feedback I got from some of our members, was whilst I think we can all relate to the concept of trust at the individual level, mm-hmm. how do we translate that into a business environment? So if I'm running a security department, for instance, and I'm working with the business, how does that trust relationship work when we're talking about perhaps sort of inanimate objects, if I could put it that way, rather than people?
Well, I have to be honest, it doesn't always translate. And I think this is really important. It's interesting you use the language of building trust, which I tried to stay away from, because it sort of gives people the idea that you can build trust in one area and then it's sort of a reservoir that you can carry mm-hmm. over to another part of the organization. It's not, unfortunately, how trust works. You have to earn trust in every situation. What I have seen is this idea called the trust stack, which I think really applies to security, that often where you have to start is actually trust in the idea.
Right.
So you can have trust in the people, but if people don't believe in the idea, it doesn't sort of filter down. So the base layer, particularly in complicated systems, complex industries, is do people understand and trust in the idea? The next layer, and it's huge, is what I call the platform. Mm-hmm. So do people have confidence in the company behind the platform, in the technology, the way that works? And then the top of the stack is really trust in the people. And the people could be a real human or it could be an algorithm these days. And thinking about that, particularly if you've got a trust issue in an organization, is it because they don't get the idea? Is it because they don't trust the organization or actually they don't trust the people? Mm-hmm. So this is one of the mistakes I see many organizations do with trust is, unlike other strategies, we tend to think of it in a very generalized way.
Right.
And we have to really focus in and what are we asking people to trust? What is actually transferable from different parts of the organization and where are we essentially starting from scratch?
Right. Now, if we look at it again from the security standpoint, a lot of organizations have come from a compliance-based mm-hmm. approach to security. So perhaps they haven't felt the need to establish some of the things that you're talking about because the policy will do that for them. You know, you mm-hmm. don't, it's that sort of don't question. We've got the policy, you need to comply with it and there are good reasons for doing it. Trust me. As we move much more through a process of digital transformation, risk transformation, we have to become much more reliant, don't we, on the individual. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what we do is done on an mm-hmm. iPad, on a phone. So the onus shifts from the organization through to the individual. Mm-hmm. What sort of tips or advice have you got for people listening to this that are thinking, yes, I'm going through that process exactly in my mm-hmm. organization? What are the sorts of things that you think they could do?
It's a really good question. And the first thing I'd say is, so I work a lot in sort of what I call risk-averse organizations.
Right.
And that's inherent in the nature of what they do, right? They're trying to reduce risk. That's how they protect people. Mm-hmm. So that could be in a major bank. It could be an insurance company, regulation, whatever it's. And we see this a lot in security, that by nature, their job is to reduce risk. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a world of risk versus a world of trust, and they're very different. So it can be really hard to get people to take those leaps into the unknown, to innovate, and also to switch from thinking about trust as something hard in products and services into behaviors, mm-hmm. into culture. And that we shouldn't underestimate how hard that shift can be. Now, I would say in the world of security, and when you're starting to think about how that translates into the individual, it's really on this integrity piece. And it's really asking sort of a simple, but it's like a North Star question. Mm-hmm. It's continually saying, is this decision we're making, is this product change we're making, is this policy change we're making, whatever it may be, this feature we're introducing, do our intentions behind that align with the best interest of the customer? Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful question because you can't really hide from that. Like if you're making a decision and you've made that decision to cut corners or you've made that decision to make more money, but it's not necessarily in the best interest of the customer, from a trust perspective, it will backfire over time. Mm-hmm. So it's how you move from sort of what I call the capability side of trust that is important in humans, but particularly what we focus on in products, to the character side of trust and really thinking of this integrity piece.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned in your Congress session was this notion that perhaps transparency doesn't always equal trust. And that's an interesting one, I think, for people who are listening here, because very many, I'm sure, will have thought, well, to be more trusted, I've got to be more transparent. So talk to me a little bit about that, this whole sort of transparency, trust balance, if you like.
And I have to say, a lot of people hate this idea. You know, it's not true. And I swallowed the Kool-Aid on it. So what is actually interesting is if you look at the first release of my book, it ends on, let's create a more transparent world.
Right.
And then when I got to update the edition 2 years later, I changed it because I'd started to do the research around this. And the reason that prompted me was I was spending a lot of time with tech companies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, tech companies that were really, still are, really under the gun. And I'd sit in meetings and I'd hear regulators and everyone was talking about transparency, right? Like if we make these systems, if we make the advertising models, if we make them more transparent, we'll fix trust issues. Mm-hmm. But when we were looking at the data, there was no shift in public attitudes or sentiment. In fact, trust was continuing to decline.
Right.
There was no change in the cultures in these companies. People weren't behaving differently. They weren't designing products differently. So that's what started getting me thinking, is this true, what we've been told, that transparency is going to fix trust problems? And then I went into financial services, and all I heard during the research was all it does is create more paperwork. And the banks will go so far, and that it's actually a good defense mechanism, because if they're called in by the regulators, they can say, no, we were really transparent with you. You right. knew what was going on. So it's like, this really doesn't feel like trust to me. So I should say transparency does play a role. Like it's sometimes the only option when you are in a very deep state of distrust. But what we have to be careful is you have to know the problem that you're trying to fix with disclosing information. So gender pay is a really good one, right? Mm-hmm. We knew that if we could get information and be more transparent around that, we could hold people accountable. I'm always wary when you have someone come in and they promise, we're going to be transparent. I'm going to change this industry and it's going to be transparent, because what the customer, the public, whoever the stakeholder is, the media, their expectations of transparency and what they want to know is often different from what the company can legally share. Mm-hmm. And that disconnect can actually backfire when it comes to trust.
One of the other challenges that security is going through at the moment is this sort of transformation of the industry, if you like, moving much more to focusing on risk rather than anything else. And of course, with risk comes a degree of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Now, you've done a lot of research and work in this particular space. So talk to me a bit about the balance between those two components, because very often when I talk to members, they are not so much struggling, but I suppose really trying to figure out, you know, where does this all fit? And they get into a discussion about qualitative assessment versus quantitative and that kind of thing. But talk to me a bit about the work that you've been doing in that space.
Yeah, I should say I'm really intrigued by problems of language. So when you notice people conflate words and risk and uncertainty, I do it. Like it's one of those things, we just use them interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And that really happened during the pandemic. So it's quite interesting when you actually dig into what is risk and what is uncertainty and why is it important to understand the difference, particularly in a world of security. So as you all know, risk is something where there are known unknowns, right? Mm-hmm. So we can in some way assess the likelihood of or probability of something happening. And we can in some way assess the impact if something bad happens, right? That's when risk strategies, when we can apply products and services and systems to reduce risk. Uncertainty is something very different. I don't often quote Donald Rumsfeld, but there are unknown unknowns, right? And if you think about the pandemic, no one knows how this will end.
Mm-hmm.
And because that is so confronting and so frightening, what we do is we look for information, vaccine rates, infection rates, whatever it may be, to try and turn this uncertainty into risk,
mm-hmm.
right? So we try to look for what are known variables in this that reduce the uncertainty. But uncertainty in itself is the unknown.
Right.
And this is the challenge. Most humans, most organizations really struggle to sit in the unknown, and they will do anything to try and put it back into the language of risk, which then becomes something that they can manage and come up with solutions and strategies around. But true uncertainty, we have to learn to sit with. And the amazing thing you see in organizations is organizations and people who are really good at sitting in the unknown are often some of the most creative people in the world. Like, mm-hmm. that's where new ideas are born. You know, there's no invention, there's no scientific solution that came from the place of the known. So I was encouraging many organizations in the pandemic, yes, there were hard risks that mm-hmm. they had to mitigate, but those exploratory spaces, that uncertainty, the unknown, how can you give people permission and support to really sit there, to discover new things, to come up with new ideas? So this conflation of risk and uncertainty is, it's a real problem and often creates sort of risk-averse cultures.
So if I'm looking at it again from the security standpoint, what I'm hearing you say is there are certain things that I can control.
Yes.
There are certain things where I can go through my risk assessment process, whatever that looks like. But I also have to have the courage to put a whole pile of things into the uncertain bucket. I can't manage them. I don't know what's going to happen. And to view that as being a positive rather than being perhaps a threat or a negative.
Yes.
The challenge that presents, I think, for perhaps some of the people listening to this is, how do I communicate that? How do I go to my C-suite and say, you know, here's a bucket of stuff I know nothing about?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm laughing because you've probably read the book Black Swan. Have you read that book? It's really interesting to go back to it. And it's just so pertinent right now. Nicholas Taleb's brilliant work. And I'm laughing because I was asked by a leader the other day, so what's the next Black Swan, right? Like, Black Swan, you're like, do you understand the irony of that question? But that's very reflective of, and I've had this conversation with many leaders is, you know, if you don't know the answer, isn't that going to undermine my credibility? Like, what people are looking for is certainty.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for reassurance. Well, we've seen this with the UK government. If you go out there and you pretend that you know, or you pretend that COVID somehow knows a date or mm-hmm. even a 9 p.m. curfew, it undermines trust. So one of the most important traits that we're seeing in the research that you need, particularly during times of uncertainty, is humility.
Right.
And humility is a complex beast. So it's the ability to be confident in what you don't know. It's the ability as a leader to say, do you know what? I haven't figured that out yet, or I'm not sure, or I was wrong, or we don't have the information. And you can do that with confidence
mm-hmm.
and you can reassure people. And when you get it right, what you're actually saying to people is, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to pretend that I have the answer. So when I do give you information, you can trust and believe that information. So many leaders sort of go with overconfidence during a crisis and mm-hmm. think that's where reassurance comes from. But humility is like rocket fuel when it comes to trust, if you get it right as a leader.
One of the other challenges that our industry has at the moment, of course, is the attraction and retention of talent.
Sure, yeah.
What is the role of trust in attracting people into an organization? Do we make a decision to join an organization based on that, or is it just one of very many different components?
It's a really good question. So one of the things that people are often thinking about in an interview situation, and this can be a virtual or in person, is, do I feel safe?
Mm-hmm.
So psychological safety is intrinsically tied to trust.
Right.
And if people don't feel safe, and that has so many different layers to it, right? I don't feel safe in terms of being able to express my views and opinions. Mm-hmm. I don't feel safe that my beliefs will be respected. I don't feel safe in terms of, I'm not sure I'm going to fit in here. that is a reason, like that's one of the first reasons they'll walk away from an organization. So how do you create that feeling of psychological safety, even in the interview process, is really important. And then deep trust is formed not when people fit in, it's when they belong, when they feel that true sense of belonging. And that comes from an organization's purpose. So there's so much work being done on purpose of the organizations, but you see it like often when people join organizations, or the way people advertise to new talent, trying to attract new talent, is they talk about still what they're selling, what they're offering, things that they're creating, and people cannot connect with the why of that organization. And if people really believe in the why of that organization, that's what pulls great talent in.
And of course, one of the other challenges that we've had over the last 2 years has been the pandemic.
Yeah.
Retaining people or attracting new people during that time has been particularly problematic, because a lot of the sorts of things you're talking about, we're used to doing by being in person, right? So you come into the office, you see who's there, you know, you get a feel. We often talk about that, don't we? You get a feel for it. Yes, I feel that I can fit in. Very sort of emotional reactions to things. During the pandemic, that all shifted, that changed. What were the sorts of things that you saw around this whole trust issue with people, and because they were remote? How did it change?
So I'll talk about my own students and the university, because Oxford's not unique. There's real trust issues with the students and asking for money back. And it's interesting, because you'd often hear the university say to the students, you need to separate out the learning value that we can still deliver online and the social value, which we can't promise you. And I would think, and sometimes voice, no student can do that, right? Like for them, being at university and interacting in the classroom and going to the pub and at Oxford, like being on the river or whatever it may be, like that's all part of the university experience. So that I think is really hard, particularly in younger people, is it's not just how I feel doing my job, it's how I feel being around people in that environment. So I think recognizing that, you know, employment can offer you sort of the professional value and pay you, but can't offer that social value, and how you reconcile those two things and just be honest about it, is a really important first step. And then I think the second step that we're entering right now, I honestly believe hybrid working is the hardest model when it comes to trust. This is the hardest phase, because before everyone was sort of in an even playing field, right? And what hybrid working does is you've got problems with communication, because now you've got to communicate on two planes. You've got to communicate in person, and equally you've got to communicate virtually. Huge problems with inclusion. Now you may have sat in a hybrid meeting, right, where there's people in the room and then there's people on the screen. I felt it in the classroom, right, where I have students around the world and then I have students in front of me. And your eye line naturally goes to the people in front of you.
Of course.
So how you make people feel included. Inconsistency, like what does hybrid mean to you? What does it mean to me? What does it mean to 1,000 people in an organization? And then I think the last thing is this very strange power dynamic that's going on, where most employees can't say to their staff, you have to come back. And yet you can't take this top-down approach. We've seen many companies like Goldman Sachs try to do it, JP Morgan. You have to come back by June. That's going to be terrible in terms of trust. So when employees have so much power and so much say, and there is no endpoint to that, that shift in power dynamics, it's, I'm seeing, is what a lot of organizations are struggling with.
And what's the answer, Rachel? I mean, what are some tips to help people address that?
I don't have the answer to that. It's not my area of expertise. I think something that we underestimate is the power of consistency. And I don't mean like consistency in the answer or the message, but I'll just give you a really simple example. So at my children's school, the headmistress was amazing. And as she explained, in 8 weeks last year, in the period of 8 weeks, she got 200 pieces of protocol from the government, 200 pieces of information that she had to communicate to her staff and to her parents. And every day it felt like things were changing. But she did simple things that were consistent. So her communications always came out at the same time. It was always in exactly the same format. It was always in exactly the same tone. So you knew at 8 o'clock in the morning what was going to happen that day.
Right.
I know it seems so simple, but you know when the communication comes out at 9 and then it comes out at 5 and it's in a different style and you're not sure where to go and what portal to go on and it's a different format, those moments of consistency are really reassuring when everything is changing.
So consistency in terms of approach, consistency of message, I guess, as well. One of the other things that you mentioned when you were talking about students and so on was this cultural piece, you know, multicultural environments. A lot of people listening to this will work for multinational organisations. When we talk about trust, are there huge cultural differences that we need to be taking into account? Again, particularly thinking here about the way that security has to evolve in the future.
100%. I mean, this is where the area of trust states that I talk about, which is, you know, culturally, there are huge differences in what trust state someone might be in a different situation. So, you know, just take the pandemic. When I look at the students, right, the students, and I spent 10 years in Australia, so I can really relate to that culture. Like, their lockdown's happening really late, right? They're in a different situation. The rest of the world feels like they're moving on. They're in a very different trust state right now.
Right.
So there are so many environmental and cultural indicators that really influence someone's trust. You know, you see in different parts of Asia, they have a very different relationship to institutions and compliance. And I think one of the things that we're starting to see, which is a really positive thing, in the same way sort of like the 80s and 90s were obsessed with market segmentation and understanding why someone would buy something, what we're starting to see is understanding why would someone trust something or not, and understanding all the different factors that may influence that.
Rachel, it's been fascinating talking to you about what is an emerging area, I think, trust and how we actually deal with it across businesses. So thank you very much for taking the time to unpick some of that for us. It's been a pleasure. Rachel Botsman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to this week's guest, Rachel Botsman. Next week, Steve is in conversation with Vivian Redding, the former first vice president of the European Commission. Redding was responsible for justice, industry, telecommunications, research in technology, education, culture, and sports. Here's a preview of that conversation.
Intelligent companies who like to have a worldwide impact will propose privacy by design to their customers. Because it is not only an element to please the European authorities, it is also an element to give security and trust to your customer. I think privacy by design will even become more important when we go to the development of AI, because at a certain moment, the insecurity of the consumers will grow. There will be scandals, there will be here and there. And if somebody can offer a product or a service with privacy inbuilt, that will be a good selling argument.
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find the catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.